men experience coercive control in very similar ways to women. And I'm talking about across the board in all elements: isolation, economic, intimidation.
Hello, and welcome to Locked Up Living, the podcast which looks at resilience in challenging organisations, such as, but not only, prisons and hospitals for mentally ill prisoners and patients. My name is David Jones, and together with Naomi Murphy, I present your Locked Up Living podcast. So, Deborah Palney is a lecturer in criminal justice and a final year PhD candidate specialising in recovery and growth in female and male victims of intimate partner abuse, domestic violence and coercive control. Having a particular focus on male victims, she has conducted two international studies throughout the pandemic to investigate the types, levels and impact of the abuse experienced by men across the world. A survivor of partner abuse herself, she prides herself on being an evidence-based researcher and therefore asserts that abuse is not a gendered issue. Good to meet you, Deborah.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Hi, Deborah. Really nice to get to have a conversation with you again. But I just wondered if we could just start with the fact you haven't always worked in criminal justice, have you? Can you describe your career pathway and tell us how you ended up studying and lecturing in this area?
Yeah, well, I've only been lecturing in this area for all of 3 weeks at the moment, but it's a fascinating topic and exactly where I need my research to be. However, it's a rather convoluted career path. I did a bachelor's degree in management science at UMIST, which is now part of Manchester University, and throughout that degree, I'd started to work for a society that got work placements for domestic work placements for foreign students and vice versa, so international work placements for domestic students. And as part of that, I had to go to various industries and ask them for placements and also ask them for money to keep our society going. And as part of that role, I went to what was then called Guinness and asked them for placements and money. And they asked me if I would be interested in working for them whilst I was at university in a programme that they were just about to start for student ambassadors, with the commercial aim of having someone on campus that would be a promoter of the brands, market the brands, maybe get in with the local pubs and have Guinness nights and that kind of stuff. And that led me to, 3 days after I graduated, I took on a full contract with what was then developed into Diageo. They'd merged with a spirits company. And they shipped me off to Scotland, where I worked for a number of years. Everyone in that organisation started out in direct sales. So you literally walked into bars and sold across the bar, regardless of where you were going to end up. And I spent a good many years with that organisation in category management, brand management, marketing, sales, account management, many, many different roles. I then went to work with a British soft drinks company, Britvic, but in their on-trade sector. So managing brands such as Pepsi, Britvic, Orange Juices, even Robinson's Cordials, those kind of things. And then I had my children and took a couple of years out and then went to work for the National Trust, looking at opening properties as a business development manager, opening properties and buying properties. And strangely enough, the alcohol industry followed me all the way through there, and I bought a pub for them. So that's still theirs and is still bringing in money to help them as a charitable organisation. But a number of things happened to bring me to a place in my life where I decided I'd had enough of commercial industry. Those events, in a nutshell, were my first marriage was horrifically abusive. And when I came to the Lake District, so with the National Trust, I ended that marriage. I'd also just lost my father at the time. But I'd also, within those years, I'd met and got remarried to my husband, John, who I'm happily still married to. And just after my dad died, I had that existential midlife crisis of what have I been doing? You know, this means nothing, those kind of things. And my husband's a drummer. He's never had what he calls a real job. So he asked me two questions that are very simple, but really impactful. The first one was, what have you always wanted to do with your life? Which was psychology. And the second one was, what is stopping you? And that is the most powerful question, because it really makes you reflect on yourself. And there was nothing stopping me at that point. So I applied for a master's degree at UCLan, mainly because it was the only university within traveling distance of me that was had a master's that was BPS accredited. And I wanted to make sure I was on the right course as well as doing something for me. And throughout my master's, I had a particular interest in psychopathy and antisocial behaviour, because I was trying to understand the perpetrator of my abuse in my first marriage. But then I was thinking, well, this is a symbiotic relationship between perpetrator and victim. Now I want to understand that side of it. And my supervisor throughout my master's was Vijay Willen, who's now my second supervisor. And she introduced me to Nikki and said, Debs needs to do a PhD. We have to make her do it. So the rest is history. And that's what got me here. But the domestic abuse focus was obviously something that was personal. But as you know, a PhD strives to find a gap in the knowledge and then to address that gap in the knowledge. And there was a number of gaps around the narrative I was reading for domestic abuse. One was that as a victim, I didn't feel like a broken, shattered, disempowered woman. I didn't feel that the person that had abused me had done so because I was a woman. And also, I'd spoken to many victims, male and female, and couldn't find a great deal of information on male victims. So that's what led me to think I need to write a thesis on female and male victims, but I also need to look at post-traumatic growth and look at that journey that enables people to not just survive, but almost thrive, albeit in a different format. So that's what's brought me to this place now.
Thank you, Deborah. And do you think, having had all these other work experiences prior to beginning a sort of second career as a researcher, do you think that's enhanced your approach to your research?
Yes, utterly. And it's something I've completely reflected on, because you do get to a point in your life when you think, I've really found my niche. And blimey, have I just wasted all those decades up until this point? And the short answer is not at all, because one of the things I discussed with Nikki when I was asking her to be my supervisor was that there's a huge amount of data that is absolutely crucially important, but sits in the dusty annals of academia and doesn't actually make it to the front line or people that it could be extremely useful for, because we teach academic language, we teach scientific research methods, and actually papers can contain really interesting data, but it can be immensely dull to read it. So I discussed with Nikki about one of the things I wanted to achieve as part of my research was being able to write in the format that needed to be published and be taken seriously, but also be able to translate that back to the public and get the message out there. So my skills in marketing and brand management and all those elements of how to capture people's interest in very short spaces of time have become crucial. Because I made, for example, I made a video that is often requested and is now spread around various outlets and used in frontline training programs and presentations, where I took just a sliver of the data I was able to gather last year. And then, and this was the qualitative data where men had literally written their experiences to one of almost 45 questions, which was, were you afraid of your partner? And if so, why? And then I pulled in a couple of favors of people that had done voiceovers or people that had been involved in various things I'd done in the past. And also new contacts that were skilled in making videos and camera work and sound engineering. And we created a 10-minute video of the voices of men. And of course, I branded it with, you know, it's all black and white, it's all very quiet at the beginning, and made it so that it was something I knew would be almost like an extended brand advert for my data. This is what it encapsulates. And the amount of people that have come back to me and said, I found that a struggle to watch because that encapsulates my experience. Frontline practitioners that have said, I've really needed something that could just encapsulate a powerful message in 10 minutes and you've got that, can I use it? And I put it out so it can be used. There's no copyright or anything. It's got all the information it needs to be on there and out it goes. And I don't think, well, no, actually, I know for certain that if I hadn't had the training experience that I had, I wouldn't have been able to pulled that together. I wouldn't be able to find the message, get it in the right format and get it out there.
Yeah, it's very powerful, that video, actually. So I think we'll try and include a link to that in the show notes, because it's literally the voices of men speaking the men's, your participants' words, isn't it? But it's very powerful. And you've chosen to study coercive control and interpersonal violence, but can you define what you mean by coercive control for listeners and how prevalent is it?
Well, we're all very used to seeing the numbers on domestic abuse that we associate with physical violence, which is over 2 million a year reported into and estimated by the Office for National Statistics. The answer to how prevalent is coercive control is we're not exactly sure. I would put my hat in the ring to say it's far more prevalent than physical abuse because it's insidious. And that's the difficulty with trying to describe coercive control, because like most disordered types of behaviour, it's normal behaviour to the nth degree. It's exaggerated normal behaviour. So, and we've got a law since December 2015, we've got the coercive control law, but it's really difficult to evidence. And I'm not just talking about the criminal justice system or the police, which are often the first people that are contacted by this, or even domestic abuse support agencies, but also for the victim. Because it's like the frog in a pot. You put a frog in cold water and you slowly increase the heat and they're not aware they're being boiled until it's too late. And my first marriage was immensely coercive controlling. The violence in it was rare but extreme. But the rarity was enough to allow the coercive control because it was the fear of everything else. But on top of that, there was layers of smear campaigning. Isolation is often the first thing. So that would be done by either falling out with friends and family directly by my partner at the time, or them just doing that whisper in the ear like, oh, they've said this about you, or they weren't there for you for this. And, you know, just planting those seeds of doubt. So you feel like you've made the decision yourself, but actually you've been manipulated into that decision. And once you've got no support network, it's really difficult to calibrate normal behavior to what you're experiencing. From my experience and now all the data and literature that I have to hand, what myself and Nikki are attempting to do is map out what we've labelled a network of abuse. So we're hoping to repeat the questionnaires that we did last year on female victims so that we can provide the same level of data for women and do the compare and contrast across gender groups. But it's, to give you an example, in our second survey, we had 45 items of coercive control. And what I'm a bit old school that I absolutely love software. I love the computer programs that and everything that we can use for data. But there's nothing quite like printing off everything and scribbling on it and getting, you know, deep into your data. So I printed off just a simple correlation table of those 45 items, stuck them all together with sellotape, put them on my dining table and started to mark either moderate to strong or strong correlations. So we'll obviously need to do a lot more work on this. But what we found is something that can be as seemingly trivial, like being put down. And I'm still talking about a pattern of abuse here where we only took sometimes, often, or always as coercive control. We mapped that out to with moderate or strong correlations to other types of abuse. So putting you down was our center point for the start. And then we mapped that against not being controlled on seeing friends or family, having your earnings controlled, being threatened with being kept from your children. And then all these other elements that actually underpinned that seemingly trivial action. And I suppose that's what's led me into working with the criminal justice and policing team, because I need to now take that to frontline services like the police and say, can you test? We hope to get an app together that the police can use to enhance their evidence taking, not to in any way overtake it. So that they can maybe listen to a victim that's saying, they put me down all the time. And they can select that and then go, okay, so we'll ask about, do they have access to their own money? When was the last time you saw your friends or family? Is your telephone monitored? And they can ask questions that might throw up particular answers. We're hoping that that would be used. It, again, as I said, it can be overridden by the police. It's another tool in their armory to help them come to a decision about whether to extend that investigation or not, not in any way to replace the police and their experience of those situations. But to summarize that very long answer, it is that coercive control is a persistent and consistent network of abuse that is used to subjugate victims and make them dependent on the perpetrator.
Thank you. And yet you also started talking about some of your research findings there in terms of the relationships between some of the variables. But were there other research findings that were useful?
Yeah, we made I'm just looking at the report now. We made a number of recommendations. But again, in a nutshell, what we found was that men experience coercive control in very similar ways to women. And I'm talking about across the board in all elements, isolation, economic, intimidation. Although the tools might be different that are used to execute that abuse, the experiences are very similar. However, there were areas that men seem to experience abuse because they are men. An example of that would be legal and administrative abuse. And the best way to example that is that, and I've been through this system, so I'm very aware of its benefits and pitfalls, and it's not a perfect system, like anyone in that system will be very aware of, because you're dealing with very complex issues. and people with complex needs at that time. But legal and administrative abuse for male victims that are in heterosexual relationships, and those were the absolute vast majority of the men that answered these surveys, is that we have a system that's set up to protect female victims of domestic abuse. And we hear throughout the media, believe women. We have a violence against women and girls strategy. The College of Policing has it. And it, all the way through the system, we have training for the judiciary about violence against women and girls, as we should. You know, we it's obviously something that we want to prevent. However, if you're a female that's been abusive or coercively controlling to a partner, that can be easily exploited. So what we found was that men are often told, if you don't do X, Y, or Z, I'll report you for abusing me or hitting me. And if you call anyone, I'll just tell them you abuse me and I fought back. Or I'll make sure you don't see the children again. I'll tell the authorities that you're abusing the children. So that's something that I say is predominantly aimed at and used against men, because we have a system that's set up to protect women. That also means that our societal expectation is that when couples separate, children tend to stay with the women. And again, I can evidence that, because 92% of all applicants to court to see children are from men that haven't got contact with their children. So you can see how that system could be easily exploited if a woman was abusing her male partner. And the same for children, actually, because we have the societal view that children will stay with their mothers. Often men either stay to protect the children from an abusive mother, or they stay because they know that they'll lose the relationship with their children and move from father to visitor. So that can often be used as a tool of abuse.
Yeah, and so just thinking about the rationale for why the system's set up in that way, is that, you know, because women are more vulnerable, or what are the theories that have driven the way that treatment and management of interpersonal violence are set up?
Well, there's a schism in the field that has existed since the field existed itself. We have two opposing camps, as it were, and it is such a shame, because if you gathered all the camps together, which is what I would like to see, then we might be en route to actually solving some of these issues. But you've essentially got a gendered perspective that tends to sit in a feminist ideology. And you have an ungendered or family-based violence ideology. And those have been the sort of warring factions since the 1970s, since the women's movement brought this subject to the fore. And we can't deny that the women's movement really did bring the issue of domestic abuse to the public domain, and needs praise for that. However, the dominant narrative of violence against women seems to be very much centered around domestic abuse. It seems to be, for want of a better phrase, a poster child for the harm of patriarchy, as it were. Even now, the larger organisations such as Women's Aid and Respect, for example, have a gendered approach to domestic abuse. Sorry, and Refuge as well, where they openly state in all their literature that domestic abuse is gendered violence, and is men committing domestic abuse against women because they are women. And it's a really simplistic, in marketing terms, tagline that doesn't actually say a great deal. It's all very good to sort of spout it as rhetoric, but it doesn't, for me, it not only doesn't explain the issues, it actually masks the issues, and it's dangerous. And the reason I say that is that, A, it's not true. We can evidence that that's not true. It's easily falsifiable. But it also means that you're not helping anyone in that entire sentence. Because you think that that's the cause of domestic abuse, men do it against women to keep them oppressed, you're not tackling the reasons why men would do that, the men that commit domestic abuse, because you're seeing it as a patriarchal oppression issue. You're not looking at, and these are reasons, not excuses for domestic abuse. You're not looking at trauma, you're not looking at ACEs, you're not looking at mental health or mental illness or all those other factors that we know come to the fore. But you're putting the solutions to that in ideology, not evidence. But also, the end of that sentence, committed against women because they are women, makes women victims by accident of birth. It makes it an immutable quality. So if you're a woman that's been victimized and you go to get support from agencies, and I have absolutely no doubt these agencies have the, especially the frontline workers that help women, and I've been a beneficiary of that. They have their absolute goals are to help those women. But if you're hearing that mantra of against you because you're a woman, how do you overcome that? How do you overcome being a woman? Are you perpetually victimized then? And it doesn't give any agency back to a victim. And we know that if you are kept in that status, you're never going to be able to tackle any trauma responses you've got from that. You're not going to be able to trust anyone, including yourself, because your agency has been removed. So I have an issue that this is, that sentence is not tackling any issues for anyone involved. And in particular, if you're not actually tackling them for perpetrators and victims, there are usually children in the centre of these issues, and they're not being protected by that either.
Yeah, it's very, very interesting, isn't it? Very thought-provoking. I suppose it also makes me think about the other part of your research, which has been about recovery and growth following domestic violence and interpersonal control, and wondered what your findings there were.
Well, my first study was a meta-analysis of very much looking for the golden nugget of what we could find that helps people recover and thrive from such traumatic events, and then hopefully try and find models from that data to transplant into victims that are maybe not at that time yet. How do we manage treatment or support to help people out of that situation? And strangely enough, that led me into looking at men, because the only studies I could find on any of those kind of support elements to help growth were on female victims, and they were few and far between. And I scoured the planet, as you do in a meta-analysis and systematic review, and found 27 studies that had a combination of elements that helped to promote positive adaption, and then other studies or similar studies that had elements that diminished negative effect. So you had two sides of the same coin. You had promotion of growth and diminishing of negative effect. And I compared that trauma of domestic abuse to other traumas. So things like disease, natural disaster, terrorism, various different types of trauma, and looked at the effect size. And that's how I was able to compare the sizes in a meta-analysis. And for things like disease, there was maybe an effect size of 0.2, with one obviously being the perfect outcome and zero being no outcome. But that's still quite a moderate, in the effect size, it's still quite a moderate effect. It's quite a nice effect to find. And I went through all these, and there were some that were touching towards 3 and 0.3 and all these kind of things. And then I looked at the data from the meta-analysis, and it was 0.36. So I then went back and started doing a little bit more research, doing this iterative process. And what the post-traumatic growth model shows is that the worse the trauma is, the level of it is, the more your capacity to grow, because your entire worldview will be shattered if it's really extreme trauma. So the difference with domestic abuse compared to disease and natural disaster and terrorism is that not only is it extended and repeated 24-hour trauma, it's also from someone that you trust, which is in and of itself shocking and traumatic. So my findings from that were very much that, yes, it's repeated, consistent, persistent, traumatic, high-level trauma, but the potential to growth out of that is equally high. So we need to try and model a resilience and support network to enable people to grow out of the other side. And again, linking back to the previous question, what will not help that is telling a woman that she's a victim because she's a woman, because that she has no agency over that. So we need to start talking to, in this case, female victims about their agency. And I've been shouted down in various formats, but particularly in social media, about talking about giving agency to victims, because it's often confused with victim blaming. Now, I've self-reflectively throughout my studies, I've asked myself, why did I stay? What was I still doing there when I was clearly not very happy? What was going on in me? Now, that's not me victim blaming myself. That's me looking for something to enable me never to get into that situation again. And strangely enough, what I brought it down to is my upbringing was very stable. My parents had a normal relationship. Sometimes they fell out, sometimes over the moon. Usually it was just normal, just humdrum life. But I felt there was a loyalty in my parents' marriage. And when I took my marriage vows with my first husband, I also took those vows very seriously and kept maintained that loyalty. So I had a responsibility that could be easily manipulated. So that's something I took with me. And when I went into my second marriage, I thought, I know I love this person and I intend to take my vows seriously and spend the rest of my life with them. However, if it gets to the point that that's been manipulated, I'm out of here. Now, that's me having agency by asking a question, why didn't I leave? We should ask victims that question so that we can find that element that can give them agency, so that if they get into a relationship again, and I hope they do, because they can get into really happy, you know, they're not broken, they can thrive, they can recognize the elements that would stop them getting out of that relationship. And that's agency. And it's difficult, but in order to get to that point, we need to have these difficult conversations.
Yeah, you see, you're kind of like highlighting there's a paradox, isn't there, by just subscribing to the gendered perspective on domestic violence, that ironically we may be contributing to people not being able to either escape that or also not actually doing enough to address things in a way that's really practically useful.
That's fascinating what you've been saying, Deborah, and it seems to me that labelling is just as damaging and restricting in this field as in any other field, and indeed any other period of history. And the real struggle is to fight to provide a space for thoughtfulness and thoughtful interaction to occur. And that's, I think, a real issue at the moment.
I think so. I think it's, again, it's a conversation that I see across various disciplines and various topics, that we're very siloed in our thinking. And it often is binary thinking. There's only two options. You're either in or you're out. And we all know that the devil is in the detail. The nuance is where the solution lies. You know, there's and I have a sentence that I say to students now, that more often than not, it's not an either or topic. It's an and topic. It's a yes, there is, you know, violent men that are abusive towards women, and there are violent women that are abusive towards men, and there is a combination of every single element of that in between. But if you look at only one element of that issue, you are never going to solve that issue. It's just, it's an impossibility. It's like doing half a jigsaw and expecting to see a full picture.
Sure. So you've already told us, really, that your field is very controversial, has stirred up a deal of controversy. And I suppose wondering why it is that talking about male victims is so controversial.
Well, it certainly is. And I've been called various things. I find quite funny. Some elements of the abuse that I get are really not very nice at all, especially when people have tried to find out what school my children are at and things like that. But I'm often called a misogynist or accused of having internalized misogyny, which I deal with that because these people tend to not know me very well. And I work on a number of projects throughout my research, including one that I literally just came off before taking this role, which was with our maternity department, talking to women, staff and heads of service in the maternity service about their experiences of providing personalised and safe maternity care throughout COVID, which was on a team of women talking about women and empowering women. And so I do find it quite amusing that I'm accused of internalised misogyny. But I presented to our cyber psychology students on Monday about this very topic, research on the internet, certainly in controversial areas. And I've linked it to a couple of things. Well, three, actually. The first one is that my research shakes worldviews. And that, by worldview, I mean a vested interest. Now, for some people, that's a financial vested interest, that they are making money from propagating a certain narrative. For some people, that will be even a research vested interest. If, you know, no one wants to get 20, 30 years down the line of their research and then suddenly think, oh, I might have missed something very early on. But then there's also a level of victims' worldview where not only have they gone, and female victims I'm talking about here, not only have they gone to support services that have given them this worldview, but it might have been something that has actually protected them through their recovery. They might have found social support through holding that worldview. They might have made friends on, you know, whether on media or in real life. It's given them goals when there's meetings to lobby or protest against or for violence against women strategies. And, you know, it's become something they've got an emotional and healing vested interest in. And all of a sudden I've come along and gone, don't forget the men, because women can do it as well. So it might be such a shock to their system, not just because I'm challenging that central narrative, but also because I'm telling these people that the people that they now trust that have helped them through this process have lied. You know, whether intentionally or unintentionally, from whatever motivation, essentially my data is saying, it's not men against women because you are women. This is a much broader topic. So for some women in this situation, they're being re-victimized by what I'm saying. So So it's their worldview has been shattered again, having been shattered as a victim of domestic abuse. The other sort of psychological theory concept I put this towards on Monday was this notion of groupthink and in-group and out-group thinking. So it's not that they are, when I get this abuse online from sort of higher echelon thinkers in the field, in as much as those that are influencing policy or influencing public narrative, it can be really aggressive, the abuse that I get. And that's not because they're trying to keep me out of their group. It's about keeping others in the group in line. And it's quite a strange concept to say that they need to, in order to keep the narrative as it is, they need to make sure that if anyone within that group think leaves, they can have an example of how they will be treated and ostracized if they dare challenge the narrative. So I find it quite extraordinary that when we're talking about coercive control and female victims, the narrative itself has become coercively controlling. And I've done some work around comparing victims of domestic abuse to prisoners of war and survivors of cults, because the model of coercive control was very first developed on men that had been prisoners of war in Japanese and Korean prisoner of war camps. And it was Albert Biderman back in 1957 that first created the coercive control model that we have today. So as I was looking at that, it seemed very interesting that it could that model could be easily applied to ideologies, whether that be a cult status or dominant narratives in the field. And I think the narrative has become coercive towards those people that believe in it, because it shows what it's like to challenge it. And you know yourself, we're very used to having psychological theories or concepts that are challenged. That's, you know, we're scientists. We hope to be challenged. We hope to move things forward or adapt them, or even take a retrospective step back and think, actually, we got it back then. We've just sort of over-egged the pudding, as it were. And things are always changing and always adapting. But this seems to try and remain static and not develop outside of what we have. So there's that. But also, linking back to the first point I made, some people are traumatized and they have no voice, and they haven't had a voice for a long time. And using me and my research to shout at is literally deflection. It's giving them some kind of control back. If they can shout at me and what I believe in, it might be the only time they've been able to do that, when actually they're shouting at someone that's abused them in the past and literally deflecting at me. So I have to try and consider all that. And some people I have absolute battles with because they are researchers and they should know better. There are some people that I have a real issue with because they are lobbying Parliament, not just to help women, but to actively exclude men, which I think is wrong. I have no issue in someone just helping women, but if you're actively excluding another group, I think it's wrong. But then there's also people that I step away from and think, I'm going to let you, in inverted commas, win that one, because I think you need to for yourself. And I don't want to be someone who's re-traumatizing you by throwing out however much data at the time. So there's a lot to juggle.
Yeah, thanks very much. Sounds like it's a very dangerous area you're working in. So,
Luckily, I'm very supported by my supervisors and university. So that helps.
Sure, but social media as well is such a toxic area these days as well, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah. And I was saying to the guys on the students on Monday, there's certain things that will affect you. There's no two ways about it. If someone's calling you all the names under the sun and tagging in your university and trying to get you thrown off things and cancelled, and there's one currently, like in my husband, who's just done a charity event for Mind and Mankind, and they're accusing them of all sorts. The other week I was accused of being sexually harassing someone. And you get all these false accusations all the time, which is in and of itself abusive. But it's also not reality. And most people that are in organisations or know you in real life understand that you're being harassed. And like my university did, put support systems in place, talk to you about stuff, but also remind you yourself that it's not reality and you can step away and go for a walk and go and hang out with your family for a bit and realise that it's not real life. So you do have to put your own ground rules in place, yeah. I think.
Okay, thank you. So moving on a bit, can you tell us a bit about, it's to do with some of your findings, I think. So do you think male victims are rare? Are there some particular characteristics about men who become victims? Are they likely to be more passive men generally? What do you think?
No, is the short answer. From our data and from previous literature, age didn't matter, occupation didn't matter, background, ethnicity, nothing mattered as far as being a victim is concerned. And for example, in Australia, we got quite a large cohort across the two surveys, nearly 1,000 men. And the largest the occupation with the largest number of participants was the construction industry in Australia, what they refer to as the tradies. So these are men that are out there doing sort of the traditional masculine roles, constructing buildings and all that kind of stuff, and that they were the largest of the occupations within that cohort. So no is the short answer. I can't remember the first part of the question that you asked.
It was to do with rarity.
Yes, and again, no. There are various studies. So Archer in 2000 did a meta-analysis that is cited often and should be cited always when looking at domestic abuse, that found that men were equally likely to be victimised as women, if not slightly more so. And then there was literature out of Canada in 2019 by Lysova et al, who looked at national survey data in Canada and found that, again, men were as and actually coercively more likely to be victimised by women. The issue for men, one of the recommendations we've actually said falls in line with this is we've spent a great deal of time, effort and money on national campaigns to raise awareness of female victims of domestic abuse. So, like I said, when I was in that, I didn't recognise coercive control, but that's relatively new as far as campaigning is concerned. But I did have an inkling that I was being abused when I was being physically harmed, because obviously we've got campaigns about that. And the coercively controlled ones, we're seeing more and more women come forward about coercive control. We don't have any campaign at all for men. So it's difficult for them to recognise it. And also, even linguistically, we've normalised coercive control for men. We'll say, like, oh, he's kept on a short leash, he's under the thumb. You know, there's all these things are linguistic indicators that something might be amiss there. You know, if your mate's not allowed out, if his wife's always checking his phone, if, you know, there's various elements that we all kind of giggle at. And when we have giggled at for decades, that now, from my research, are not funny anymore, because I'm now asking that question of, what do you mean you've not seen him in how long? Do you get to speak to him? You know, is he all right? Have you asked him? What do you mean he doesn't play football anymore? Oh, she doesn't let him. He's right henpecked. You know, oh, right, okay. So even these little markers are something that we've normalised. So if we've normalised it, men have normalised it. You know, we tend to think, I think it was, I can't remember her name. There's a quote, Camille Paglia, she's a feminist. She's got this beautiful quote, and I can't remember it verbatim, but she actually talks about how young men have this element of freedom between control by their mother and control by their wife. There's a kind of short window of running around with other men and having some freedom. And actually that really stuck with me, because I'm thinking, oh crikey, this view of patriarchy and men being omnipowerful and having the freedoms that come from that theory don't seem applicable really. And has that dampened down our recognition of what a male victim experience is? I would say, yeah, absolutely, 100% it has. So one of our recommendations is to have national campaigns to highlight how men are abused, and also start having touch points. What I noticed from doing that research with the maternity departments was that there are touch points for women going through various health paths where they are asked explicitly, is everything okay at home? Are you safe? Have you got any support? And I was talking to various men, friends, colleagues and family saying, are you ever asked this? You know, what are your touch points? And actually there aren't many sort of timetable touch points. Like for women, you'll have invitation for a smear test every 3 years. You'll have your mammogram. You'll come in contact with a lot of healthcare when you're pregnant, or all those kinds of things. There doesn't seem to be that level of touch points for men in the healthcare system. So should we be going elsewhere? Should we be talking to, should we be putting these campaigns in, and I hate to be stereotypical, but in mechanics, garages, in dentists, in hair, in barbers, in, you know, on the back of pub toilet doors, in sort of where men gather, you know, essentially finding in football grounds, in all those places. And again, my marketing background starts kicking in, and I can see where these posters need to be and where the campaigns and the you know, are you henpecked? Is your mate henpecked? Is he under the thumb? You know, all those kind of things come back to me on those kind of things. So again, long convoluted way of saying men are equally likely to be victimized as women across all levels, including physical violence, because women tend to weaponize, certainly in coercive control. And we need to have campaigns to raise awareness.
Thank you. Some very interesting ideas there, Deborah. So again, thinking about men and women, and I think I know what your answer is going to be, is female violence less serious than male violence? And how about motives? Do men and women have different kind of motives?
Well, you won't be surprised to hear this, but no is the notion for, is male violence more serious than female violence? Because what we've tended to do, and we're all guilty of doing this, is, and I seem to be saying this over and over again recently, is we take an apex fallacy and we apply it to everyone involved. And what the gendered narrative has been very good at is marketing. You know, I recognise their marketing strategy is immensely powerful. So we often hear 2 women a week, although that's now been changed to 3 women a fortnight, because we've actually seen a decline in women being murdered by their partner. But we don't hear any celebration about it. We don't hear anything saying, you know, we've put these things in place and they're actually working, because it doesn't follow the narrative that this thing is being tackled for whatever reason. And that's probably a completely different podcast. But so women tend to weaponize. And again, literature and our data shows that women use ordinary everyday objects. Kettles and boiling water seem to be one that was relatively common. Kitchen knives. And they also tend to attack when men are vulnerable. Or whether that's because they're asleep or they're inebriated or under the influence of some kind of drug or alcohol. But women also threaten to harm people that men love, including children. And it's terrifying that this is happening to adults. I find it unbelievably painful when I'm reading this, when they start talking about harming children. It's something that actually does affect me and I have to manage. But it's not true. We focus on women because that's the way the narrative is taken, and nobody should be absolutely murdered in their own home or ever, but particularly here. And again, I can completely relate to that. I've been strangled to the point of almost passing out and thinking this is it. I understand the fear that women experience in this, but that two women a week or three women a fortnight, however that is positioned, is not the whole story of domestic abuse. And then on the flip side of that, and again, we don't have solid numbers for this, but there's an estimation that around 11% of suicides in men are linked to not having relationships with their children or even being victims of domestic abuse. And that works out about 10 men a week, which is, if we're going to do a comparison, five times the number of women that are murdered each week. But the end point, people actually dying from this. Surely we should be focusing on 12 people a week are being murdered or losing their life because of domestic abuse. Let's tackle all of that rather than just a sector of that. So it's serious to the end, to the point of people losing their lives about it, whether it's through murder or people taking their own lives.
Do you know how frequently women murder their partners, Deborah?
Yeah, again, there is numbers there that say it's around a third of the number of women that are killed are men killed by their partner. So if we're talking 100, it would be around 30, 32 men that are murdered by their partner. But again, this is where the media and the narrative takes hold of this. Often when we hear of this, there will be a reason behind it. The woman was abused, or she was suffering from some form of mental illness or trauma response or something like that. Quite rightly, we should look at all those elements that have caused that. But then when that's applied to a man, it's because he's a man and he's a monster and he should be locked up forever. And there's that real empathy gap between how we view women that perpetrate this type of act and men that perpetrate this type of act. And it's based in the narrative construct. And again, to be honest, and this is reflected in a huge amount of literature, the most common form of domestic abuse is bi-directional. And that might be because emotional deregulation, or they grew up in a family where that's how emotion was expressed, and they didn't, people weren't taught the way you can either regulate your own emotion or deal with conflict in management in another way. So should we be prescribing conflict management to couples? Should we be having couples therapy so that people aren't just in repeatedly destructive relationships? Because actually they might love each other and they might do well together and prosper if we actually give them the tools to manage conflict differently.
So, Deborah, do you think the system, and thinking mainly about the legal system, because you've touched upon media already, does the system deal differently with male victims and female victims?
Before they even get to victims, I think it deals differently with perpetrators as well. We often see this conflict in numbers, where research in the community research will show that men and women are equally likely to be victimized. Then we get into the Office for National Statistics that says 1 in 3 victims is a man, but that's based on questions that can be very much focused towards women and men not recognising their victims, and then the system not recognising their victims. And then you get conviction rates that show that something like 95% of convictions of domestic abuse are men. But then if you look at the whole of the criminal justice system, not just that specific piece, the Home Office produced a report, I think it was in 2015, that said that men are overrepresented and women underrepresented in the criminal justice system. So as a man, you are 6 times more likely to be convicted of the same crime convicted by a woman. You're 6 times likely to be convicted. And then when you are convicted, it's likely that your sentence will be 3 times longer. And they absolutely attributed this to gender. So it's unsurprising that that would then be magnified when applied to domestic abuse that holds such a gendered narrative. And I'm writing up my thesis at the moment, and I'm doing a piece on systemic bias against male victims. And I've looked at the Office for National Statistics guidelines, I've looked at various agency guidelines, the domestic abuse laws, the coercive control framework, and you'll see this manipulation of numbers all the way through, where they just don't talk about men. You know, we know from the government's own statistics that at least 1 in 3 victims is a man, and then there's no mention of it in government papers. And this is because they'll put the Duluth model in and talk about violence against women and girls strategy. I'm going to put this again in my thesis and hopefully put this out to publish, that I took some reports on economic abuse, especially because our findings show that men are abused economically, where these reports just say that this is something that women only experience. But in one of the reports, there's enough data to just plug into a T-test. So there's all these different questions that were asked, and I've got the number of women and number of men that were asked that question. So I was able to do a T-test to see if there was any difference. And the report itself starts with an introduction that frames this as a violence against women and girls issue and post-separation. And then it talks about how they've included men and women. And you can see that the numbers look similar just from a layperson's perspective. And then it says, oh, well, we don't think the men that said they experienced economic abuse actually experienced it, but it just needs further exploration. And then they just go on to talk about how women experience this. So I took those numbers, stuck them into a T-test, and I think there's about 4 sections that they've put this questionnaire in. So you can easily just put those numbers in and do a sort of men against women comparison. Is there any scientifically significant difference? And the answer was an absolute no. There is no scientifically significant difference between the number of women and the number of men that have said they've been economically abused. Why hasn't anyone done that before me? Why hasn't anyone taken those numbers and stuck them in a T-test and said, not only can I see as a layperson there's no difference here, but actually, on a scientifically, statistically significant level, there is no difference. What you're playing at? Because it's not, no one's asking those questions. I suppose because I'm so focused on it, that's what I do. But these reports were written in conjunction with a bank that prides itself on ethics. And in my sort of commercial brain, going back to my account management days, I'm thinking, if a bank isn't testing these numbers, what other numbers aren't they testing? That would throw that ethical bank into some kind of, why didn't you look at these numbers? This has got your name on it. So it's just, the more I dig, the more I find, and the more I get frustrated with it.
But I suppose that's the importance of scientists like you to look into new areas. After all, child abuse wasn't really researched to any great extent until, 50, 55 years ago.
Absolutely. And it's a prickly topic, not just because it's dark for me, to sit in this area every day and research this and talk about this. And it's not the nicest thing to be talking about all the time. But like most people that go into these areas, it's because I want to find a solution for people at the end of it. And I repeat this often, I have no issue in any organisation being gendered focused, and I have no issue in any organisation having a particular belief system that they subscribe to. My issue comes is when that system and those organisations are then actively excluding groups to maintain that ideology. And as much as I get slaughtered for it, it is the absolute truth. We have to step out of that ideology and understand this is an and debate, not an or debate.
Thank you.
And are you referring there to, for instance, Deborah, things like access to refuges, things like the Violence Against Women and Girls Act, which is obviously incorporating men and boys in there, but how accessible is it if it's called the Women and Girls, Violence Against Women and Girls?
Absolutely. I would, although I don't think domestic abuse is a gendered issue, I think often the support needed can be a gendered subject. So we know, for example, that women tend to communicate eye to eye when talking about trauma. Men tend to heal shoulder to shoulder. And there's, again, the literature supports the fact that a lot of men cope and heal through active coping, doing active work and talking to, or not talking, just working through it themselves. But what we tend to do is refer to this thing called toxic masculinity, which I absolutely 100% detest. It really is a thorn in my side. And we blame men for not talking. And what we've done there is we treat men like dysfunctional women. And you'll have heard me say this over and over again, stop treating men like dysfunctional women. As a woman, I talked about my trauma and then actually found that I needed to do something to get out of my trauma. I don't want to talk about it all the time. I want to go and do something. And I think that's something we should investigate across the board. But certainly for men, we need to have a gendered approach where it's more active based. Yesterday at university, in a lecture for criminal justice, we did one last week about what is justice and who is it for. And we had a non-profit organisation that kindly came to take the lecture for me called Lads Like Us. And these are guys, that have been in touch in various ways with the criminal justice system as committing offences. And got into all sorts of trouble with drugs and dealing and alcohol and drug dependency and all the rest of it. And they now go and help lads like them, young men that are homeless or they experiencing elements that are indicators to go down that path. They're actually doing things. And what I wanted our students to understand is that there's very blurred lines between what is a victim and what is an offender. And the guys told their experience of neglect and a sexual abuse and physical abuse throughout their lives and what had taken them down this wrong path, as it were. And for me, they were saying that they healed by doing things, getting involved with things, taking actions or hanging out with men and creating safe groups for men where they could go and talk about this with people that got it. I hear this phrase from men a lot. I'm not going to go and talk to a psychologist. They don't get what I've been through, or they don't get what I've experienced. What do they know? And I think peer mentoring, certainly for men, is a crucial element that's missed off, that's really missed off a lot of treatment programs, certainly local authority treatment programs, where it tends to be a short hit of CBT and on your way. So I think there needs to be a gendered format for recovery.
Thank you. And are there any other implications of your research for treatment or reduction of interpersonal violence that we've not spoken of already?
I think we've, again, because we've had such a strong narrative of get women out of a situation, what we've neglected is very much a couples therapy approach. Again, the most common form of domestic abuse is bi-directional. So these are people that are equally abusive, whether it's physically, coercively, whether it's triggered by alcohol or trauma or whatever. And just taking one person out of that situation and then letting them, you know, telling them it wasn't their fault and letting them go on to something else doesn't actually help that person. And actually, if there's children involved, you've got a broken down family there that maybe if we'd have done something as radical as, and I'm doing the inverted commas radical, because it really isn't, having some kind of couples therapy or family therapy, having the whole family involved with this and seeing the impact that has on everyone is, I think, is necessary. But also, I think we need to have some conversations around resilient supporting so that we are not keeping people in victimhood for the rest of their lives. We're asking difficult questions that are not about victim blaming, but like I said, about why did you stay there? What prevented you from leaving? So that we can then give you those tools that enable you to leave if you're ever in that situation again. So agency, rather than this sort of catch-all empowerment word, agency and knowledge, I think, but having that underpinned as resilience and thriving as opposed to just masking the issue.
Thank you.
So, Deborah, can you tell us how the government is attempting to deal with interpersonal violence, and have you and your colleagues got involved in this?
Well, there's various people that are we're kind of converging as a group of people. There's academics like Nikki and Liz Bates and Ben Hines, and people that have been out doing this for a lot longer than I have, that are actually talking to victim commissioners. And for example, Nikki was at a consultation with the Office for National Statistics yesterday, along with Mankind Initiative, and they're turning up at the table and putting the evidence across and having debates and opening this. But on the whole, like Naomi alluded to, there's, for example, the Crown Prosecution Service still has a violence against women strategy that male victims sit within. And we want that to be separated because it's still used. Those numbers are still used accumulatively to gain funding and action for violence against women and girls strategy. So the one in three male victims that's lumped in with that group is used to support women, but not used to support a parallel violence against men and boys strategy. There is glimmers of hope, like in the domestic abuse framework, there is actual acknowledgement that male victims exist, and £500,000 put in there as funding towards it, which disappoints me because, again, Office for National Statistics shows that 786,000 men were likely victimised last year. So that's not even £1 per victim as far as funding is concerned for male victims in that framework. But it's a foot in the right direction. You know, we've cracked that door open a bit, and at least our names on the list, we might get entry. But again, that's also clouded by the usual Duluth model and men's oppression of women and all that kind of stuff. We just need to keep showing up. We need to keep putting this data out there. We need to keep putting reports out there, like the one I did with Nikki, based on this data. And we need to keep raising awareness, and podcasts like this, you know, getting it out there to people that have maybe got an inkling. Because I've had, again, on social media, as much as I've had abuse and harassment, I've also had people kind of sidling up to me virtually, people that are within these very, very gendered organizations, messaging me and then emailing me saying, I want to talk about male victims, and I've never had this data before. I saw your video. Is there anything you can give me that I can go and present to them? Because I think if I give them the data, then maybe they'll understand. So there's people out there, you know, I'm not trying to tar everyone with the same exclusionary brush here, that there are people that are coming forward. But I think it's running through treacle, isn't it? we're trying. And the more this data collects, the more of this data we collect, the more this body of research, and it really is a heaving body of research now, it becomes like a juggernaut and it can't be ignored anymore.
Thank you. Just to clarify, and for people who don't know, like me, you've mentioned the Duluth model several times, and I've heard you mention it okay. in previous interviews. What are you referring to there?
This was a model created from a feminist organisation that got a group of women together and asked them about their experience, and then mapped out what their experiences of abuse were concerned. And actually, the behaviours that are in that model are absolutely mirroring of domestic abuse and coercive control. It talks about isolation, controlling money, using children against you, sexual abuse. There's various elements in there that are absolutely applicable to domestic abuse. The issue comes with that, and I've critiqued this in a chapter of the Male Psychology Handbook, where they now take that great work and apply it to an ideology. So then that becomes all these behaviours are perpetrated by men against women because they are women. And I've actually done a lot of research reading what is now classed as vintage feminist literature, where there's influential books. So a guy, for example, a researcher, Lewis Oaken, wrote in, I can't remember if it was 86 or 88, about domestic abuse, myths and facts about domestic abuse. And I'm rolling my eyes when I say that title. And in that, he talks about all the various different ways that feminism can manifest, be that equity feminism, Marxist feminism, radical feminism, all the different elements of it. And then he says a line in that says, however, all feminist researchers essentially ignore male victims because we believe it to be either non-existent or trivial. And that line is very much mirrored in the development of the Duluth model. The Duluth model was then expanded to say, now we need to get this into all agencies, be that the police force, the judiciary, the Crown Prosecution Service, the whole of the judicial pathway, courts, judges, everyone else, needs to follow this absolute ideology. This is the map. This is how domestic abuse works. And if we're going to monitor that it's done in this way, you have to completely subscribe to this belief system. And if you don't follow this prescribed path, you will be held individually responsible for it. So if you're a police officer that's been monitored on how they manage domestic abuse and you don't follow that ideology, you will be pulled up in front of your superior and asked why you didn't arrest that man And if you say because it's a victim, they've got the prescription that says male victims don't exist or it's trivial. What had he done to deserve that? And he's flipped into a perpetrator. So the reason I critique it is because it's mapped out to be the core of the gendered model. However, when Nikki was doing her PhD, she created something called the controlling behavior scale. And she took all the elements from the Duluth model and adapted them to be gender neutral. So all the elements I talked about with isolation, sexual abuse, using children, controlling money, preventing you from working, all that was in the controlling behavior scale. Now, with a few additions from literature and in our second survey, the information we got from our first survey, we used that to discover the experiences of male victims of domestic abuse. And that's why I'm very comfortable sat here being able to say men experience domestic abuse and coercive control in similar ways to women. Because essentially, we've used the elements of the Duluth model that is used to assess women to assess men. And they're all but for a few differences, which you'd expect, there is a core of very similar experience across the gender.
Thank you. So, I mean, it's another useful lesson in how there are no absolutes in the social and the scientific world, even that things always have to be.
But even the authors of Ellen Pence, the author, one of the co-creators of the Duluth model, in her follow-up book, said that they were very much aware that they were trying to impose their ideology of power and control onto men. But when they discussed this with men, that it wasn't about power and control at all. They even then, on the same page or the next page of the book, say, we even ignored women being brutal to children because it didn't fit with our narrative. They admit it themselves.
Thank you.
Deborah, you're researching an area that must mean you're exposed to a lot of information about the human capacity for violence and cruelty. And you've spoken about how you've got your own resonance with that, with some of those themes. How have you managed to ensure you keep yourself emotionally uplifted and nourished doing the research you do?
I do a lot of things. I do a lot of self-regulation. So I'm very lucky to live in the Lake District. So I literally live in a mountain range. There's a mountain right outside my window as we're speaking. So I go out and walk. My husband is, I think if he wasn't a drummer, he'd be a stand-up comedian, and just kind of laughing through it, I think, just taking my way about it. We do tend to have a gallows humour between myself and my supervisors. And I think that also needs to be recognised, that sometimes laughing at serious, really dark subjects can just give you enough space to be able to cope with it. But actually, if we're honest about this, this is a small percentage of people that are certainly doing the extreme levels of abuse. It's I'm not saying that abuse is common in garden, but the extreme levels of abuse are very that are relatively rare. Most people are lovely. Most people are really lovely. And I do see that as much as I see the darkness in some people, I really tend to focus on the positiveness. In fact, I had a conversation with a colleague and student of mine today about what they're doing for their essays. And because I'm only 3 weeks in, we were talking about what got me there and you know, sharing the stuff. And we're of a similar age. And actually, we've shared similar life experiences. And we were discussing the fact that not only do you have, if you've been through that kind of trauma, not only do you have the ability to be able to spot potentially abusive people, you can see the behaviours pretty quickly, but you can also see people that have come through it and grown, and you gravitate towards those people. And these people are often some of the best people you'll ever wish to meet. They take life for what it is. They take joy out of really small, ordinary life events. and they're bloody funny. they see the world for all its gore, but for all its glory as well.
Thank you, Deborah. And one of the things that I had wanted to ask you about, but was about your commitment to critical thinking. But I think actually we've so much of what you've spoken today about today has been like presented as a case study of why it's so important to think about things critically and not just fall into the same way of thinking of about stuff that you that people are used to.
Yeah, it's something that I've I'll probably finish on this if you want to use it, but something that I've really taken to heart, in as much as I really drum it into my children about asking why, and why would someone say that? What is it if they got a motivation behind it? How, why did they choose those particular instruments? Why did they choose those kind of things? And I often recount this, that when my daughter was I think she was 5 or 6, maybe 7 max, I'd taught her into like drilling down into things. And it was morning, we were trying to get ready for school. I was making packed lunches. It was a bit chaotic. And I can't remember if it was had been her birthday or something, but we had chocolate fudge cake in the house. And she came into me and she sauntered in and leaned against the door frame and said, "Mum, what are the ingredients in a chocolate muffin?" And we sometimes have chocolate muffins for breakfast at a weekend or whatever. And I said, "Oh, you know, it's like still making these packed lunches." I said, "Oh, it's flour, eggs, chocolate, milk, sugar, this kind of stuff." And she went, "What are the ingredients in chocolate fudge cake?" And I was just about to start explaining and I stopped, unwrapped the chocolate fudge cake, cut a slice off and handed it to her, because I thought, actually, she's done her critical thinking and has backed me into a corner where I have no argument. The same ingredients exist in chocolate fudge cake as a chocolate muffin. And if she's allowed a chocolate muffin for breakfast, I can't go back on the chocolate fudge cake. So, yeah, critical thinking can help a lot, especially if you're a 6-year-old after chocolate cake.
Thanks, Deborah. That was a great conversation.
Brilliant. No, I enjoyed it.
Lovely example at the end.
Absolute pleasure.
Great.
Interesting conversation with Deborah, and I think Deborah highlights a lot of information that kind of goes against the narrative that we have about victims. So this idea that a third of domestic violence or coercive control victims are male, and that reminds me of, you know, the looking at the Office of National Statistics data on victims of crime. 11% of women who are killed on the streets, which obviously is awful, but actually that contrasts with 38% of men who are killed being killed on the streets, and men are killed in a much higher frequency than women are killed. So actually the streets are more dangerous for men than they are for women, and yet I think this focus on the streets as dangerous for women means that as a woman, you feel a lot more frightened walking home than you might do if you think that that any men you know walking home are actually at far more risk than you are. And perhaps that's not a very helpful narrative for us as a society to be focused on.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point, Naomi. And I did find a lot of what Deborah said was really interesting and challenging. Certainly I can remember as a young man that I was frequently frightened on the streets or on the footpaths, and I'm sure most men have had experiences where they felt they were under considerable threat.
Many thanks again to all of you who have listened to our Locked Up Living podcast. Feel free to mention this to your friends and to your colleagues, and give us feedback on our webpage, lockeduplives.com, and our Twitter account, Locked Up Living. Many thanks too to Pete and Rach, who kindly allowed us to use their music, You Have Called Me Courage, and this is available from all the usual outlets.